Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Comics Arts Conference. We're an academic conference that takes place here in the heart of Comic-Con. We have 16 panels. We'll be here in this room every day from 10:30 to 3:30 all weekend. We've got programs on the table in the back that are just for our programming, which you can pick up. On the back of the program is a call for papers if you want to participate either here or at WonderCon in some of the CAC programming. We also have CAC shirts that you can buy at the Comic-Con merch booth over in the Marriott. This year's look like this.
I am professional.
So our first panel today is Bradrica and Carol Tilley, who will be talking about some of the early history of comic scholarship in Scholar Number 1, Lost and Found, Comic Studies Genesis.
Just move down. Cheers. Thanks for coming, everybody, at this very early hour of 10:30 a.m. Just kick off the CAC. So you may notice there's only two of us here today. What we're going to talk about, and we'll talk about why that is, but what we're going to talk about, I wanted to try and think of a way to frame it. And I thought about our obsession as comics fans, comics readers, over first appearances. You know, right now there's somebody downstairs, you know, haggling over this issue of Strange Tales because they have to have the first appearance of the Dread Dormammu. Or this issue of Avengers. Anyone know why this issue of Avengers is important?
Peter Henry Garrett.
Close. First appearance of... It's very timely, it's very topical. He can shrink from a normal... Well, here's the thing. Exactly. I knew Pete would get it.
It's the first appearance of Scott Lang, isn't it?
It's the first appearance of Scott Lang, not Scott Lang as Ant-Man. So this raises the question I think that we want to talk about today. We very much want to do this as a conversation because it's early and because it's summer and you shouldn't really talk about too much academics in the summer, right?
Absolutely.
Because there's a hazy spot. What a first appearance really is. You know, it's not the first appearance of Ant-Man, but it is the first appearance of Scott Lang, so people eat it up. This is Sean Howe, who was supposed to be here today and let us down by not being here. And I'm just saying that because I know Jamie's recording it and he's here and going to say, well, why'd they do that to me? He really had something else he couldn't get out of, and he expresses his regrets that he couldn't join us today. But he's very much a central part of today's story. And he also wrote Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, which we're going to hawk for him, even though he didn't show up. It really is an excellent book, and you should read it. And he also looks like Daredevil, doesn't he? So our story starts here, at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And Sean wrote me about a year or so ago, and he said, hey, I found this, in doing some research, I found a master's thesis. And it's called An Approach to the Profession of Comic Strip Cartooning Based Upon an Analytical Survey of Current Trends and Personal Experiences. Classic academic title. A thesis submitted for the degree of Master of Science, University of Wisconsin, 1942. That's all really cool. You know, that someone's writing about comics in 1942 at an academic level, at a higher academic level, really awesome. But here's what made it even better. By Paul Henry Cassidy. Sean said, is that the Paul Henry Cassidy? And we decided that it pretty much had to be. And it turns out that it was. Paul Cassidy, born 1910, died in 2005, was also one of the first ghost artists for Superman. Here's one of his covers to Action Comics 29 in 1940. He worked out of the Schuster Studio in Cleveland and then later through the mail. But one of the bigger ghosts on Superman. And this, all of a sudden, this graduate thesis was really interesting. It's written by someone who worked on comic books, who worked on Superman. So we finally got it, and we'll get into how we got it, which was not easy. But I wanted to show you some highlights from it to get an idea of what was inside. As part of my research problem, Cassidy wanted to collect judgments from leading cartoonists, syndicators, and publishers of the country. In other words, he sent out questionnaires. His results were not very, and I'm going to go through some of the things he got, were not very statistically, what's the word I'm looking
significant.
For? Significant. Significant for our own use today in 2015. You know, he sent 156, he got 60 back, 12 returns were from the syndicates, and he plays with the percentages a little bit. If he was doing this as a master's thesis today, I'm not sure it would fly. In fact, I'm pretty positive it wouldn't fly. But it's still interesting to us, if not from a statistical standpoint, certainly from an anecdotal standpoint, and I'll show you why. So here's his questionnaire that he did send out, and I want to highlight a couple questions that I think are interesting, and some, even though some of the results are rather small. If you do a page rate basis, is it uniform throughout the feature? And that was an answer of no. If you're working for if you're working on a page rate basis, it was not the same throughout the feature. The other question is number 9, to what extent do you use ghost artists or assistants or apprentices? Yes, 3, no, 2. This is C, analysis. The next one that was yes, 3, and no, 2 is, do the suggestions and criticisms received in fan mail greatly influence the course of your features? And that was yes, 3, and no, 2. So it's giving us a little, even though it's not statistically, and I'm using that word a lot to kind of cover myself here, there's a lot of interesting things to look at. And the last one, do you have any standard layout regulations as far as panels per page, the size of the title panel, et cetera, et cetera? And only one respondent answered yes to that. 3 no's. He also asks questions about authorship. Is the current feature you are drawing the only one you have done for publication? 4 people said no. Did you work on this feature in the capacity of an assistant before achieving the byline on it? 4 replied no. 1 added that it has no byline, which I think is very telling. And this question was about the assistant, the apprentice, the ghost. Does he do A, pencil lettering, pen lettering, pencil backgrounds, ink backgrounds, pencil figures, inked figures, except for heads and faces? And we have a nice little table of what respondents said. That 4 did pencil lettering, 21 did pen lettering, 5 did pencil backgrounds, and 16 did ink backgrounds. Note that 0 did pencil figures. 7 did ink figures, except for heads and faces. And I think except for heads and faces is a direct kind of nod to the Schuster Studio, where very famously, you know, Joe said, well, you can draw whatever you want, just let me do the faces, which was to some extent true. And the one I thought was the most interesting is that last question. How many of you ghosts or assistants or apprentices work on ideas with the author? And 1 person said yes. And that person actually added it as a comment. And here we go back again to the question of to what extent do you countenance the use of ghost work, assistance work, or apprentice work? 2 syndicates said an outright no. 8 organizations indicated, that's okay, we'll use ghosts, but only when necessary. And they list due to illness, military service, and they said the standard must be maintained, allowed with discretion, etc., etc., and only minor use. So what he was getting back was that ghost work was not being encouraged, but was being allowed only in the direst of circumstances. He also gets to that question, do suggestions and criticisms received in fan mail affect the course of the features? 3 reported yes. And Six said, you know, things like they help our judgment somewhat, to some extent, some, et cetera, et cetera. We think about the great tradition of fan response in comics and how editorial response. Qualified approval. In this next part, he goes into a kind of mini, and Sean really liked this part because he's a big Carl Burgos fan, and Human Torch fan. So he got, Cassidy got a letter back from Timely, and they said, they respond with this great kind of mini biography of Carl Burgos is presently in the army, and we would love to give you all the information we have regarding his strip. And they say he is the co-creator of the Human Torch. He is one of the original artists, and he would gladly be drawing him today, but he's in the army, so we have Ghosts work on it now. But note they keep the artist's name in with the character. He doesn't disappear as the ghosts come to the forefront. This feature, the Human Torch, was created by us with the assistance of Mr. Burgos. I mean, it's a great line. It has been continuously drawn by the same artist with the byline. Really interesting from Marvel Time. But he's in the army. We are temporarily using ghost artists. Cassidy also talks about taboos, which, you know, are hand-in-hand with comics. But the respondents say that there is no written moral code, and I like this line, it is not posted, but it is effectively administered. We all know what's wrong. We know what it looks like. We know how these people should be drawn. But it's really, this is something we know about from looking at editorial letters and things like that, but to see it put this way is kind of interesting. No reference to racial characteristics or religion, and no foreign words. No smoking, no drinking, no allusions to divorce, no use of the name of the deity. He also talks about librarians, which was really great, and I know you like this part too. Shockingly. But the librarians had concerns over comics. One library is fighting this quote-unquote comic menace by building up as a set of heroes and supermen, such characters as Beowulf, King Arthur, Robin Hood, Odysseus, Roland, the Cid, etc., etc., to kind of combat this fervor over the costume-clad adventurers, which is really the opposite of what's happening today. But you can kind of make some other... you know, I think some interesting connections to how librarians are using comics as a bridge to some of these other literatures. The part I like the most about this huge master's thesis is he talks about some personal things. And he calls this part two, analysis of my own personal experiences. Again, I'm not sure you can get away with this in a master's thesis today. He talks about his life as an artist and his work in the Schuster shop, which is really interesting. And he goes on saying, you know, I answered this ad in Professional Art Quarterly. You know, I got this job working for Superman. This is my favorite line. And he said, well, I did all this work. That was the general type of work I did for several months. All that time, neither the artist or author had seen me. This was all through the mail. No one knew who he was. He was truly a ghost. And he says, gives us the dates when he started, which was actually not something we knew for sure. He also gives us a little bit of a glimpse into his process as a comics artist. And what he brought to the Superman comic is what he called two different kinds of scene, the atmosphere scene and the detail scene. Atmosphere scene and the close-up detail scene. And here in the thesis, he unveils his never-before-published comic Hemisphere Patrol that he was trying to get syndicated because, of course, it looks awesome. There's planes and there's a guy with a square jaw. And it's actually pretty good. and it takes place in the far off, you know, unbelievable date of 1960, with an exclamation point. So using Hemisphere Patrol, he shows us, you know, how he puts together a comic, going from the atmosphere panel, which is kind of bigger, you know, kind of a wider, not necessarily wide in dimension, but a natural or artificial stage to something, a close-up of a human being. There's something peculiar about this, Sergeant. And he says if you alternate these two, you get an ongoing action, you get the reader involved. And if you go look at his Superman work, it does just that. So before I turn it over to Carol, what I kind of took out of the Cassidy thesis is what really struck me is, like anyone's, I think, I mean, this is, you can argue with me on this, is, you know, your academic work, I think, reflects your personal, the personal, I think, especially if you're very passionate about it. So I don't think it's any coincidence that Cassidy is very concerned about ghost artists. At this time, he's asking questions about them. He's trying to figure out where they fit into all this. And I think it all comes together at the end where he says some really nice things. He says, the comic strip is misnamed. It started as such, but now it is rather straight serial fiction, shorthand novels. And while life in the strips bears little relation to reality, the people in the strips are completely real to many of their followers. They're not meant to be funny. Their real stock in trade is the knowledge of people, places, and things which is revealed in them. Consequently, many of them have changed, as change is the law of every living organism. If they had not changed, they would have died out. Now, this is kind of the exact opposite of Superman, but he's telling us that these things sort of have a life of their own. And he goes further to say, if you want to get into comics or cartooning as a writer or as an artist, what should you take? Lit classes, you know? History, composition, spelling. Modern classics, as Mark Twain. What he's doing with the thesis is trying to, I think, understand the ghost, but also help the ghost. You know, he turns this in, and it's signed. You know, we didn't find anyone else who had checked it out. except for... in 1983, but he legitimizes it. He legitimizes the ghost, and we were talking, you know, maybe this is what all this early scholarship is doing. I think he definitely has, I don't want to call it an axe to grind with his thesis, but he has a personal stake in it. So this is Sean, and, you know, when he found this, I said, where did you find this? You know, I did research on Superman stuff for a long time, and other people longer than me. He said, oh, I found it in a Google book search. Sometimes it's that easy. So, if you want to read the entire thesis, you can. It is housed, there's one copy, at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And they've digitized it, because they digitized it for Sean and I. And you just have to go through. There's a number of ways you can do it. If you're in a, if you work at a higher education, school of higher education, university, college, just request it through your library. If you don't, go to a library and see if they can request it for you. Or you can just go to your alma mater, see if you can get it that way. There's a lot of ways you can do it. Find a good librarian, they'll help you get it. So that's the call number if you want to go get it and read the whole thing for yourself. We consulted mightily with Jeff Trexler, who I wanted to thank for helping a ton with this. We couldn't say for sure that it was in the public domain. In fact, University of Wisconsin, we figure, does own it. So all we can do is point you where to read it yourself. One more thing before I give it to Carol. The kind of, you know, there's always a twist to it. So at the end, he gives a list of all the people who wrote back. It's quite a list. None of this survives that we know of. We checked a little bit. We haven't gone up there. It'd be nice to see letters from some of these people. The part that interests me are the personal interviews with Jack Leibovitz, Whitney Ellsworth, etc., etc. I wonder if those exist. Somebody here should find out. What I did, oh, and the other thing too is he also includes the pitch letter for his last big work, which was the K-Metal from Krypton, the story where Superman dies, which is really interesting. And he leaves the studio right after that. So what I could do, I tracked down his kids, and he has two sons, Larry, and he responded, "What a terrific email to receive." And I said, "Hey, your dad wrote this master's thesis. Have you heard of it?" And he said, "No." What a terrific email to receive. And his other son, Dick, said, "This is a surprise. I knew Mom got her master's degree at Wisconsin. That's when and where they met, but I didn't know Dad did that as well." So that was cool. And, you know, even though he's a ghost, he's a Superman ghost, so nobody talks about him. People know who he is. He was given as the kids say, a shout-out in the last... Did I really say that? I shouldn't have said that. In the last Superman movie where there was Cassidy Pup, which they said was a direct... you know, for many, he's the Superman artist. And Sean and I were like, wow, we found the first graduate thesis in comics. That's like saying, wow, I found the first Ant-Man. No, you didn't. Scott Lang's in this one. There's more out there.
So I want to talk about some of the more that's out there. And what Brad and Sean didn't know was that at the time that they were finding the Cassidy thesis, I had been busy combing all of my secret librarian databases and search tools, also looking for early comic scholarship. So some of you know a little bit about me, but I'm a former librarian, and I have a PhD in information science, and I like to think of myself as Barbara Gordon on steroids. So if it's out there, I can probably find it. And I had not been looking necessarily to find the first comic scholarship, but I had been looking for early comic scholarship that would help me with my other work on kids and comics and reading throughout the 1930s and 40s and into the 1950s. And what I'm going to share with you today isn't even necessarily the first of the things I found, but I want to share with you a few of the early, more extensive, mostly graduate level projects related to comics of various kinds that I found that I think will do a nice job of sort of fitting in with the Cassidy thesis in terms of illuminating what people were doing in the 1930s and 40s with regard to comics, in terms of the variety of methods people were employing in studying comics early on. And I think what's most important to me is the fact that it allows us to see that what those of us who are doing in terms of comic scholarship isn't necessarily new. It's something that's been around for nearly a century at this point in terms of scholarly work. And I want to start off with a 1932 study, and this is not a thesis. This is the man who wrote this, Emery Ruby, was a recent college graduate. And in 1931, he was hired to be head of the journalism school at Drake University. He had no journalism experience except that he had been involved with his college publications. But Drake had experienced a huge loss because George Gallup had just left Drake University to go to Northwestern, where he made his career. And George Gallup is the person who pioneered media polling and media preference polling in the U.S. And Gallup had gotten his start looking at newspapers in the late 1920s and what people were interested in reading. And he'd done that while he was working at Drake University. And so Emery Ruby came in, succeeding George Gallup, And it appears that maybe he needed to have a little bit more schoolwork or training in order to really be thought of as a competent director for the journalism school or the journalism department. And so he put together a survey of sorts of more than 1,000 kids, ranging in age from 14 to about 20, who were readers of Sunday comics, Sunday newspaper comics. And what he did was he employed the Gallup method. And the Gallup method didn't necessarily rely on surveys or questionnaires. What it did do was it sent out researchers to sit down with readers, in this case kids, of different ages, both boys and girls, and about equal numbers, and look at the newspaper with them. And so they would go through the Sunday section, and they would talk about the comics as kids looked at them, and talk about what about the comics was appealing. And so they would look at individual strips. They would mark up the newspaper pages and write little notes about how kids had responded to particular comics. And Ruby and his students who worked on this project were really interested in seeing how comics preferences changed with age, how they were affected by social class. So he grouped respondents, the kids, into four different social classes, with kids who had professional parents who had professional or owned business at the top, and then people who whose parents were unskilled laborers in the lowest rung. And they looked comic by comic that appeared in the Des Moines Register on Sundays and came up with this extensive list of preferences. And one of the things that came out, and it's much more extensive than I could talk about even in an hour, is that Ella Sanders was the overall favorite. If you look at boys and girls and across ages and across social classes, and kids responded to that with comments like it was real life, that it had clever repartee. And I'm trying to imagine a kid saying, you know, clever repartee about comics, but apparently someone did. And so there are wonderful quotes through this. The interesting thing is that Mr. and Mrs., which was the least popular strip, still had more than a 70% like rate. So kids really weren't that picky when it came to comics. It was all pretty exciting stuff to them. But it's really fascinating to read through the tables, to look to see how kids responded and how all of that changed with age. Boys were much bigger fans as a whole of Thimble Theater, which was the Popeye strip at the time, but girls certainly enjoyed Ella Sanders, which was a nice sort of teenage-focused strip. So that's one of the earliest studies that I found. And again, this wasn't a graduate thesis of some kind, but it is like graduate-level work done by this man who was the head of the journalism department at Drake. Writing the next year for a master's thesis in journalism at the University of Texas was this gentleman named Alfred Mellinger. And I don't know much about him, except that I figured out he had done some work for the WPA as a writer. A lot of folks who would have had his background would have been employed by the WPA in the 1930s. And what Mellinger was doing is similar to what Cassidy did 10 years later. Mellinger was interested in comic strip artists, and he was interested in their professional work in terms of their training, their art background, how they had gotten their start. And so he attempted to contact every syndicated cartoonist working at the time, more than 100. He did hear back from more than 50 of them. And this is just a guy sending out letters saying, will you tell me a little bit about your art background and training and your work in comics? So he had more than 50 cartoonists who responded with written letters. And he heard back from pretty much all of the rest via their syndicates. So they sent him their bio statements from the syndicates or other similar information. And so he put together this wonderful thesis, which doesn't really do any kind of great analysis. It doesn't really provide any summative kinds of data, but it does offer readers half to a full page on each cartoonist who responded, talking about their work, talking about their training, how they got their start. And so you can see a little bit of the data that very few of them were college graduates at the time. There were some who were high school dropouts. Many of them had gotten some sort of art training, but most of it was through either correspondence classes, night school classes of some kind, or occasional drop-in classes at a salon or an art students league of some kind. So a lot of them hadn't received formal training. But then there are these wonderful little bits sprinkled throughout. For instance, this bit from Walt Munson, who wrote about cartooning, that it's a gift, like whistling through the teeth or pocketing the eight ball or singing tenor. And so I love that you get these glimpses into the working lives of the cartoonists who were popular, who were in syndication at the time. A few years later, there was this grumpy guy, Lewis Smith, who was getting a master's degree in Colorado. And he was interested in English language education. And he recognized the fact that comics had wide appeal. And at this point, you're looking at comic strip readership in newspapers that was exceeding the 95% rate among kids. So kids were reading a lot of comic strips. And he wanted to figure out whether the comic strips had any legitimate literary quality to them. And so he was looking at things like characterization, like emotion, and what he called significant ideas. So whether they talked about important things or they were more like what we would think of as a sitcom today, just sort of a daily living kind of thing. He did something amazing and incredibly obsessive compulsive. He figured out every newspaper in the US that ran Sunday comic strips. He worked with someone at his local newspaper office to determine the circulation for each of those newspapers. He figured out which comic strips ran in these newspapers, and he was able then to figure out the average circulation for each of these comic strips that were syndicated across the country. So if you look, the top eight strips by circulation, he's going through and tabulating across nearly 1,000 Sunday newspapers and looking to see what strips were most widely syndicated, and thus, he believed, probably most widely read. And so I don't think that any of the top eight strips would be a surprise, things like Gasoline Alley and Little Orphan Annie and Thimble Theater. The lowest was this strip called Sentinel Louie, which I believe he determined had a circulation of about 5,000. I'm not sure what paper that was in, but it was. There's a little snippet of it that you can see in the back there. What he determined, what Lewis Smith, the grumpy English language master's candidate, determined was comic strips are crap in terms of literary quality. He said they don't do much in terms of characterization. It's a lot of stereotyping, a lot of flat characterization. And I can get that. I mean, I think in 1938, there probably was not a lot of innovation in some strips, but I think he also misjudged. I think he went in with a bad attitude. So sometimes personal preferences and personal biases can overshadow the research you do. He said that there were really no big ideas that people talked about in comic strips, and that he understood that kids liked the stuff, but what would really be good is if we could come up with an educational comic strip that really integrated good literary qualities into it, that that would be an ideal kind of innovation. Now, Lena Roberts Smith was less grumpy. I should say that Lewis Smith went on to be, he went on to get a PhD, and he taught college literature in Minnesota. And I don't think he ever did anything else with comics. Lena Roberts Smith was a sixth grade teacher in West Virginia. And when she was working on her master's degree, she wanted to do something to help her understand whether or not her students could make sense of editorial comics in newspapers. And this was actually not a new kind of research line. There was a gentleman at Columbia, Lawrence Schaefer, who in 1930 had done similar work. And Lena Smith acknowledged him in her thesis. But she was saying that where he had looked more widely at ages and had required young people to write their interpretations, that she was doing something a little different. She was just going to look at her sixth grade students and some of the others in the community where she worked. And she was going to give them a multiple choice kind of questionnaire to fill out to judge their understanding of these cartoons. One of the interesting things that came out of this is that she points to an even earlier study than Schaefer's study. Somewhere out there, it may not exist anymore, there's a study from 1925 from New York University with a woman who's also looking at how children respond to editorial cartoons. And unfortunately, I think it may not exist anymore. I have found two citations for it, but no evidence that there's a print copy. I hope that maybe on a dusty shelf somewhere in the basement of the library at NYU, there's a copy of it that someone's forgotten about. I'll go to look for it this fall. But what she did was really cool. So she gave them cartoons. She went through and found representative cartoons in various Sunday papers and looked at them. And what she discovered is that kids, regardless of their IQ, which she was able to correlate with their performance, do really well at understanding editorial cartoons. They get it. And she really saw that cartoons and comics have the potential to be a good learning tool, particularly for kids and in situations where subjects may not be particularly interesting, or for kids who have some sort of learning or reading difficulty. The last study I want to talk about, because we're running out of time, is this from Charles Cridland, which is 1949. So it's after the Cassidy study. This I'm really excited about, and I hope that you might be too, and I'm going to write a little bit about it for Heidi McDonald's The Beat website in a couple of weeks. Charles Cridland was, like Cassidy, Paul Cassidy, involved in the comics industry. Cridland was the treasurer for the David McKay Company, which had a line of fairly popular comic books that reprinted mostly King Features Syndicate comics, so Ace and Magic and others. And what Cridland wanted to do for his master's thesis in business admin was to look at sales and to really get inside what was going on in the comics industry, to understand how sales mechanisms worked, how publishers decided what to publish and when, whether there were any seasonal patterns in comic sales. And he drew on his own company's records, which I don't think exist anymore. But we have the snapshot from an 8 or 9 year period in the 1940s. He also used the Auto Bureau of Circulation statistics, which anyone who's tried to use those documents know are incomplete, and he was able to verify that they're incomplete. And he used a mimeographed publication created by George Daugherty in the 1940s that tried to sum up some sales figures. And I know that Bob Bierbaum may have some of these Daugherty reports, but I think he may be the only person. So that that Cridland is relying on these, I think, is pretty awesome. We get an extra look. He did find some important information. He did hear from other comics publishers, but they didn't want their names attributed with the data because he said, you know, everyone's trying to make a go of it in the business. This stuff is proprietary, and no one wants it known that they've talked to me. But he's saying that for publishers, you know, the break-even point at a 400,000 print run was about 50 to 60% sales. He was able to determine that there were probably more comics returned unsold than were produced within a few year period, which I think is pretty amazing. And he's able to document with more precision the sales of comics throughout the 1940s than I've been able to find in any other source. And he was also able to document that there really were peak sales months, that January and August, that was it, that there was a spring slump. And so his data, which is really rich, I think offers us some new insights into business practices for publishers. And it certainly illustrates the profound decline that David McKay experienced in the 1940s with its sales, because by the year after he published his thesis, McKay had pretty much dissolved and gone out of business. And you can see that in the sales figures that he reports. So that's what I wanted to share in terms of scholarship. And I know we have a few minutes left for conversation and follow-up. So Brad?
Do I have any questions? I don't have any questions. Do you have any? I mean, my only takeaway has been with, I mean, so part of this, when we first came out with the Cassidy discovery, you know, that's not the first comics. We kind of stand by it a little because we think it's the first one that has data on comic books. But my takeaway is always, you know, in 2015, you have to ask Carol Tilley first. You know, before you say it's the first anything, it's Scott Lang, is it Ant-Man, right. You know. But yeah, I think we're ready for questions.
Yeah, and I would just add, I think that, and both Brad and I mentioned this before, but just the idea that I think with comic scholarship, we have to look beyond comic books, we have to look beyond superheroes to really get the full range of what people were talking about. I mean, you can even go back even further, depending on how you want to define comic scholarship. There were folks writing about newspaper production in the first decade of the 20th century who were also touching on comic strip syndication and editorial cartooning practices. So you can go back even further depending on how you want to define things.
And but this last one's going to be really, this study's going to be really interesting.
I hope so.
To see, because for so many years it's just been, oh, the kids loved comics.
Right.
You know, what does that tell us?
Nothing.
You know, so to have actual numbers is going to be really interesting.
I saw a hand.
Yeah, I got a question about the Cridland study. Did you get a chance to look at how a lot of the case stuff was reprints of strips as opposed to original material?
Mm-hmm.
So was there any way to be able to break down comparative figures with other parts of the business? I mean, the correlation is that the strip material over the 15 years from 1935 to 1950 was in a big decline anyway.
Right.
And original material was on the rise, but the overall business was getting cut off at the end of the war. Is there any way to figure out from this data how that correlates?
So he does note that the preference was for original material, and he talks about the decline of the reprints. He provides summative data for all comic sales for all publishers, but only specific data for the McKay's publications. So he wasn't able to break down things beyond that. Now, he does also look at representative comics, 10 or 12, which he can't name because of these proprietary concerns. And he looks to see what average sales are over time. So there are some interesting breakdowns within this, but it's very difficult to see what, say, you know, Action Comics would have been selling versus Ace Comics.
Does he talk about distribution at all?
Yes, he does. He talks about distribution and return practices and all of that. So we have 2 minutes left. So I've got a hand. Yes.
Yeah, regarding the capacity presentation, motives for the actual thesis, aside from getting a master's, did you find any evidence for him using that information to maybe ruin his ghostwriting career or helping his friends or?
No, I mean, it kind of, I mean, to be blunt, but it kind of, it ends there. I think it was more of a personal thing where he's trying to work out and trying to say, you know, trying to rescue his career a little bit. Because at the same time, you know, you have to think, he's writing this thesis, he's off Superman, and Superman's still, you know, going crazy. He's trying to say, you know, I was a part of this, my part mattered. I think there's an echo of that in there.
Where did he end up in mind?
He did stuff for World Book. He has a really interesting life, kind of all over. But he did a lot of illustration for World Book Encyclopedia. Ended up in Chicago, yeah.
One last Minnesota. Question from Nikki. With this, it starts at 1940. There's partial data, and full data starts in 1941.
So there's nothing prior to that?
Not that I've found. Sorry, I know that would help you.
I got excited.
No, I wish there were earlier stuff.
So thanks, everybody. Yeah. If you wanted today's Carol's day, she'll be here right now. Right now. And then later on, she's going to be on Saturday, Spotlight on Craig Yeo, and I will be tomorrow, Twisted Roots of the Comic Industry, with Nikki Williniskin back there. Thank you.
Thanks.